very much, Richard. I see one hand up already, so I'll just move straight to that without any further ado. That said, Joy.
Hi, Richard. Thank you so much. That was really inspiring. You reminded me of when I was living in Italy in the late 70s, I was teaching in a secondary school and I used to periodically give the kids a test and they couldn't get their heads around the idea of a test. They kept turning around and copying from each other and helping each other. And I was used to that thing where in the 1950s and 60s, you had your head down and your arm round your head and you hid your answers from your fellow students so they couldn't see what you were doing. These children in Italy were used to cooperating. They had a situation where in the afternoons they'd do their homework. It was called studiare insieme, studying together, where they all did their homework together. And it was a totally alien concept for me as a partly Italian kid, but brought up in Britain. And these children not only formed friendships in school, but they remained friends for the rest of their lives. And it was a really moving experience for me. So what you said was it just rang so true for me. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's a great story, Joy. Thank you. I like that. I mean, it's actually been said that one of the very best ways of learning is cheating. Cheating is actually a very good way to learn. It's a good technique to use.
I think Morgie is next.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Richard. That was very enlightening. Yes, I picked up on quite a few points there. One is that I do believe competition is a learnt behaviour. Where I live in New Zealand, we get a lot of these competition things on television. I don't pay for cable television or anything. I just get what we call free-to-air television. So it's all the rubbish programs. And it's all these competitions. And you know, they're quiz programs, they're cooking programs and baking programs and sewing. Now they're doing floral art. But I just absolutely hate them. I hate seeing people being put under pressure and made to feel inadequate if they don't win. So I don't watch those. One program I absolutely love, which is a British program, is The Repair Shop, because you're watching experts at work. They're doing great stuff. It's not competitive. There's no money involved. There's no competition. You're just watching experts at work and seeing how grateful people are when they've done a good job. And I think that's a wonderful program. So that was just one point. But yeah, I can't understand why people get pleasure out of watching these competitive programs. You know, people, things like The Apprentice, where people are just made to feel inadequate. They're just there to try and impress some rich capitalist how much money they can make for them. No, that doesn't appeal to me at all. The other point I want to make is I've been a music teacher for the last 50 years. And years ago, I went into a Rudolf Steiner school. I was asked to teach music to the juniors there. Oh, they were an absolute pain in the neck. In most junior groups just love singing, and if you sit and play songs for them, they'll sing their hearts out and have a good time. But oh, not these kids. They were taught to be competitive right from the word go. And once they knew the song, if we did the same song again the next week, or they knew the words, so they wanted to come in quicker than the next person. And I had to keep slowing them down and trying to explain that music is organized sound. We all have to do it at the same time as each other for it to sound good. But oh, no, these kids didn't want to do that at all. They knew the words, so they were going to get in quicker than the next guy, you know. So it's a terrible thing. I hate any sort of competitive behaviour like that. And I think it would be lovely if all schools were like the Italian schools, where children just helped one another and didn't feel they were competing. Thank you.
Do you have any comments? Richard?
The only thing that was going through my head at that time is that I spend much more time than I really should on American political websites, sort of talking socialism to a lot of right wingers. And the one thing that you find on the biggest insult that they can actually give you is to call you a loser. It's so sort of central to their perception of the world. You know, it's like if you're a socialist, it's because you live in a basement and you failed in life. You failed to have your own business and make a lot of money. This winning and losing is just absolutely central to their sort of conception of the way they you know, of what of value. It's their values center around this idea of whether you have won or you have lost. It's horrible, really horrible.
Okay, Brian is the next person I see with his hand up.
Yes, thank you for a very enlightening talk, Richard. I found it very uplifting as well. But also I thought at the same time that the party has never given anything specifically out in regards to competition, and especially dealing with the nuances as you did in your talk. You know, as very glad of that. But having said that, and that be the case, I think it's about time the party, or the EC at least, started thinking of asking you to get a pamphlet together in regards to competition and cooperation, because it's dearly, dearly, dearly needed. Just one observation. That's what I've made, and it came from talking to a member of the working class on the street stall in Cardiff, a Polish guy doing his PhD over here in the UK in regards to chemistry. We were just talking about the competition of capitalism and all the rest of it. I was finding hard to get funding for a particular route of research he wants to do. And he said it's actually dealt with the competition of capitalism, that capitalism distorts and delays the scientific progress in many ways, he says, because instead of looking at what is required and needed desperately by society, it looks at the profit. What is profitable for capitalism? If it's not profitable, it will delay any progress on that particular subject. You know, if it is profitable, let it go ahead. The other thing as well that I noticed with the scientific research that was used by capitalism is that it'll use science itself in a competitive way to distort perfectly respectable scientific research and conclusions. A good example of that, or a couple of examples of that, in fact, is the work that was done in regards to smoking tobacco. Right? So much scientific work came out of that lung cancer was due to smoking tobacco. Right? And then right on top of that, then you had the tobacco manufacturers and cigarette manufacturers trying to distort that evidence all the way down the line. They give in the end, like, you know, and they had to admit, yes, the scientists are wrong. The other one then is the most recent one, and that is climate denial. How climate denial was used specifically by the fossil fuel industry, and they used emptied of scientists, right, to distort the message of scientific progress, etc., because it was not profitable, right? And it's still not profitable, right? To go off one manufactured process, i.e. the refining of oil, right, as it's done presently, and take up another manufacturing process in regard to refining of oil, right, which is far less profitable. And so it goes on. And this is, you know, this is capitalism. Capitalism will use competition every time that it requires them, you know, it pops up. But it'll also use cooperation when it is profitable. If it's not profitable, it won't use cooperation whatsoever. It just gets in the way of ensuring the maximum use of profit. That's all I've got to say. Thank you, Richard. Anyway, I do look forward to you doing a pamphlet.
Cheers. Yeah, I when I originally wrote this talk, it was about twice as long, and there was quite a lot of I found quite a lot of information about the way in which capitalism distorts, like scientific research, for example. But I thought that was something that was a line of argument that we were we were more familiar with. I mean, absolutely brilliant. I think what you said is dead right. So I kept it on a more sort of abstract level. But yeah, what I have a friend who is a scientist, and he says very much that it's when scientists are competitively seeking grant money, they will lie, they will distort their research findings, they will do all sorts of things to get the grant money, and of course they will actually restrict what they're actually wanting to research. It becomes less wide-ranging, their research, in order to make sure that they actually drew down this grant money competitively. Yeah, absolutely.
Paul?
Yeah, okay. I'd also like to talk about something related to the academic world, and in particular to an area of academic research. I'm not going to go into the details of what it involved, but it implied that there would be teams of researchers in different institutions who'd be working on the same set of problems, and that these would be, and their results would go on from year to year, and there would be a kind of common measure of evaluating how well they were doing. So there were teams of researchers, and one survey of how well this worked came to the following conclusion. This is a quote. Both the fellow feeling that comes of working on the same problem and the modest dose of competitive tension have been productive, end of quote. So in that case, a mix of fellow feeling and the modest dose of competitive tension did help to make researchers improve their results and the whole field in general improved. So a bit of competition did some good there, apparently. Okay.
Yeah, apparently it does, so long as it's not too much. That seems to be, that's a good example. Thanks. Yeah.
I can send you a bit more detail about that if you like.
I would actually, yeah.
Yeah, okay,
I'd like to see that.
Not immediately, but yes.
No, when you can.
No problem, yeah.
Okay, next in the queue is Dougie.
Yeah, I mean, I play chess, and, you know, I don't mind losing if somebody plays better. I mean, Capablanca, one of the world champions, said he hoped to lose more games because he would learn more from it. He tended to win all these games because he was one of the strongest players. And also football and things like that, and tennis. Tennis is very gladiatorial. You know, you only get one winner at the end. You don't get a draw in tennis, right? You know. But, I mean, people can admire skill in sport and realize, you know, they've been beaten by a better player or whatever, you know. But, I mean, I don't know. I'm just talking about sport, really, you know. I've watched football players. My dad used to take me up to all the Rangers games, so you'd see some good Scottish players or whatever. And I remember going to see Scotland play Argentina, and everybody said, who's that number 10, you know. Maradona was such a good player, right? You know, he just stood out, you know. So people can stand out in competitive football and things. and you've just got to admire the talent that certain people have got. I mean, chess. I mean, I don't mind losing at chess if somebody plays better than me, really, you know. So, just interesting to hear stuff about science. I mean, I did a PhD in zeolite catalysis, and it was always the dark art of how to make a catalyst, and they wouldn't tell you exactly how they did it because they'd be worried about people copying it and infringing copyright. You know, they'd put in a patent, and it wouldn't really give the details how it was made, so people couldn't copy it. So they didn't share the science, really, you know. So that's one of the things that goes on in the scientific world, and, you know, the sort of corporate image, you know, that goes with things. Anyway, I'm rambling a bit, yeah.
Any comment, Richard?
No, it's fine. Yeah.
Okay, next I see is the Socialist Party meeting, which I think is actually Paddy.
Yeah, that is me. Thanks for doing that talk, because it was you covered a lot of ground, and
seems to be no response there. I'll move on to Brian, who also has his hand up.
Yes, as a further aspect of COVID, I said that I completely forgot about, but I should have remembered it. The bloody class warrior that I am. And that is the competition of the class struggle itself. How it spurs on the class struggle, the competition between capital and labour, how it spurs on innovation and possibly productivity increases and efficiencies, simply because of the outcome of the class struggle. Right? If the cost of labour goes up, right, the capitalists are then motivated to find more technical advances, etc. I think that's about it. Yeah. Thank you anyway.
Any comment, Richard?
No, it's fine.
Nope. Okay. I see Alan Johnson next.
Oh, I could talk now. I've just on.
Oh, sorry.
I forgot.
Sorry, Alan and Paddy, but Paddy was there, but wasn't there for
a moment. Sorry about that. That's a schoolboy error, forgetting to unmute. I was just going to say that, thanks for doing that talk, Richard. It was sort of, dare I say, magisterial in its scope, and Brian Johnson must have read my mind, because I made a note to, like, can we have a pamphlet on this, because there's obviously so much stuff, and it's such a powerful argument in our favour, I think, that we actually very rarely make, I would say. I mean, you don't often see, you know, this sort of thing discussed in, you know, standard articles and whatnot, so there's that. I had a couple of other thoughts while I'm on. I enjoyed that the bit you were talking about, where you went to look up what was being said in favour of competition. You went to all these different institutes and think tanks and discovered their justifications, and I was quite enjoying that, and I thought, actually, you could play that with anything, couldn't you? It's a kind of double think, you know. You could take any circumstance and turn it around and put arguments in his favor. And I thought of arguments in favor of having a bullet in the head, and I came up with five. So a bullet in your head would remove your personal anxiety and stress. It would reduce your carbon footprints and future costs for the NHS. It would create opportunities for young people and motivate them to try harder. It would stimulate the arms and funeral industries. And it would benefit charities by freeing up your second-hand clothing and resources. So lots of arguments in favour of a bullet in the head. So I just made a note of that, because I thought, this is what they do with competition, isn't it? They ignore all the bad sides and come up with these bullshit justifications. couple of other things. You mentioned this idea of reverting to type in a scarcity. You know, this idea that, you know, if the scarcity, oh, we go back to being savage animals. And that struck me because Ursula Le Guin actually does take this for granted and describes it in The Dispossessed. She describes one episode where the abundance sort of collapses and they all go back to fighting. And we've always kind of assumed this tacitly as well. And that's why I think we've always leaned quite heavily into this idea of abundance, you know, that socialism is dependent on an abundance. But recently, I think some of us have started to question the idea of abundance, partly because people find the notion of abundance quite improbable and utopian, at least from a capitalist perspective. And I think, and personally, I think sometimes the party has made some rather grandiose claims on this that I think are probably not supportable. And I think actually we've taken a position that is somewhat counterproductive. People don't believe it anyway. And also, I think sometimes we would struggle to back up what we're saying. Maybe it's time we reframed this question more along the lines that you were talking about in terms of what is the minimum required for socialism to be feasible. So there's a thought to sort of chew on. One other small point, despite the breadth of your coverage, you actually didn't mention animals at all. And I only mention this now because I've just been in the middle of finally getting around to reading Kropotkin's Mutual Aid, which those of you who have read it will know is was written in the 1900s, so it's 100 years old. But as far as I know, and I did a little bit of research, and I can't find I can't find anything that suggests that it's, you know, its conclusions are wrong or it's out of date or anything. The argument in Mutual Aid, for those who don't know, it's a study. Kropotkin was a he basically studied animals. He was a naturalist, and he studied animals in very cold areas where the likes of Darwin and Russell didn't go. And he came to quite a different conclusion from most Darwinists, not Darwin himself, but most Darwinists, which what he said was, cooperation is not just a prime factor in animal behaviour and evolution, it's the prime factor, with competition being relatively rare, surprisingly. And that goes for insects, fish, birds and mammals, and, of course, us. And when you sort of bring that dimension into the argument, you begin to realise there's nothing that unusual about humans. All the things that you were saying about humans being cooperative, actually, most of that goes for most animals too. So if we were looking at a pamphlet, there probably ought to be a chapter on that too. And that's me. That's it. Thank you.
That's kind of interesting there, because I've often wondered about this whole thing about abundance. And we always seem to treat it as a sort of all or nothing event. Either we have complete abundance and therefore socialism, or we have scarcity and socialism is therefore impossible. Whereas in fact, you know, sort of, you know, scarcity is possible under in a socialist society. There can be crop failures, there can be all sorts of things. We can hedge against them far more effectively than capitalism can. You know, we can, for example, stockpile non-perishable goods to any degree that we actually want, with all the excess labour that we're actually going to have, which sort of capitalism ties up in useless activities. So we can stockpile, you know, for moments when there is a lack of goods available, or we can switch to new different sources or new different products to replace the old under those kind of circumstances. We don't need total in abundance at all. I mean, you know, hunter gatherers generally live in what is often regarded as a condition of abundance by anthropologists. They have everything they need. They have very little, but they have everything they need and everything they decide they want. In fact, they very often deliberately reduce their wants in order to have more free time to socialize with one another rather than actually sort of being productive. But, you know, sort of there are occasions when, you know, the hunt comes back empty handed and they have to go hungry for a day or 2 days or 3 days. It's like, you know, these things don't actually destroy their society. They can cope with these because, you know, it's like I think there is, you know, once a particular form of society is established, there is a kind of inertia. You know, we see that in the working class. The working class sort of hang on sort of desperately to capitalism, are unwilling to make changes. And that's because of this same sort of inertia of the status quo. It's, yeah, of course, it's because we're all very propagandized as well. And sort of, although we're propagandized, every society in a way builds its own ideology, which had to protect its status quo, whether this is actually done in a class society or a non-class society. I mean, sort of hunter-gatherers, or at least immediate return hunter-gatherers who are not a class society, they have no class ideology to protect, or they have no class relations to protect with an ideology. They are egalitarian, yet they have a very, very strong ideology about what is valuable and what isn't, and how one should behave and how one shouldn't, which actually enables them to find their way through periods of lack of resources when the hunt comes back empty, and that sort of thing. So or when more recently, for example, when they're attacked externally and their society does not break up. Their society resists the incursions of capitalism, of the loggers and post-colonial governments who are ashamed of having such primitive people in their midst, as often is the attitude. So, yeah, so I think this thing about abundance is a bit, we over-egg the pudding there a bit. And the thing you said after that was, what was it? You said something after that sort of rang a chord with me as well.
About animals, was it?
What were you saying about animals?
Cooperation is.
I've got you. Yeah, I mean, I think it's this idea about the difference between cooperation and competition. I think these days, at any rate, it's very well understood that cooperation is of fundamental importance within species. It's within, you know, I mean, even what's his name, who wrote The Selfish Gene. I'm getting elderly. I keep losing names. Even he said that he wrote The Selfish Gene in order to provide a logical and scientific explanation of cooperation within humans. Competition is in evolutionary theory is now very important in terms of interspecies rivalry, but within species cooperation is very fundamental, as you say, within not just within mammals and human beings, but in all sort of departments of the animal kingdom and in the plant kingdom as well.
Alan Johnson next, please.
It's just to raise a point that I don't think Richard went into very deeply, if at all. It's the most basic competition, and that's sexual competition, the competition to breed. I remember a long time ago talking to a feminist, and we were talking about alpha males, etc., why women tend to choose alpha males rather than go for the feminine, the male with a feminine touch. And she freely admitted that it's to do with procreation and developing the most likely person to, the most likely offspring to survive, which is the alpha. And this is, again, touching on what Paddy and yourself saying, in animal species, competition to procreate seems to be the most primary competition. That so basically, like to hear, and also a lot of the competition that we see in business, education, etc., seem to be substitutes for this sexual competition. Success in business is seen as sexual success. Who else would say that people like Murdoch can attract young women if it wasn't for the fact of the thickness of his wallet rather than any sexual prowess? So just want to even hear Richard's viewpoint on sexual competition.
I don't know whether competition in business is kind of sublimated sexual drive or not. I don't know how you would argue that one way or the other, to be honest. But certainly in hunter-gatherer societies, there is a certain individuals, particularly young males, will sometimes, in a completely egalitarian society, they will try to assert some level of status. They will, if they're a particularly good hunter, for example, they will try to assert a certain level of status, which might have a sexual origin. So there may be some instinctive drive there. But fundamentally, societies are actually cultural entities with cultural learning. So these kind of hunter-gatherer societies will soon make sure that any their cultural values will soon make sure that anyone claiming status will be put very soundly in his place. So there may be an element of it there, but I wouldn't assume that that it is primarily instinctive sexual in nature. I always use an example we do have instinctive drives, there's no doubt about it, but these can be overcome by cultural and social learning. The example I often give is I'm a motorcyclist, and one of our instinctive drives is target fixation. If you see a threat, you will fixate onto it. You will look in that direction, and your senses will become alert, but you will focus on the threat. That's an instinctive reaction. If you do that on a motorcycle, you're dead, basically, because if you're barreling into a corner and the corner actually is the threat, the hedge coming up or the wall coming up straight ahead of you is the threat. So there is an instinctive tendency to want to focus on it. Now, you have to not do that. You have to learn to look around the corner, to turn your head in the direction you want to go. People who are into Alexander technique know this. Your body will, when you want to go in a direction, you turn your head and your body will follow. So you have to learn to overcome this instinctive way of focusing on a potential threat. And it's not easy. It actually, for some people at any rate, it's not easy at all. You can go rigidly focused on the threat, and you literally have to force yourself not to look at it and to look away. And that's done through social learning. We do it through the accumulated experience of others. It was okay on the veldt. It was a survival technique on the veldt. On the sort of A24 or whatever, it could be quite threatening. So, we do have instinctive sort of drives. But the other thing was, I think the research, whatever feminists say, I think the research has actually shown that where women will tend to sort of go for sort of, you describe them as alpha male types, if they're looking for a sort of a sexual encounter, when they're looking for a husband who is going to sort of bring up their children, they choose very differently. So there is this issue as well. So I think this is more complex. I think you may have a point, but I think it's more complex than that. Yeah, that would be my pennyworth.
Okay, next we have Mike.
Thanks. Hello. Thanks, Richard, for your talk. Yeah, I enjoyed that very much. And interesting discussion so far as well. Status was mentioned in the last couple of contributions. I suppose that's what I wanted to mention was about. And the talk earlier on of school days got me thinking as well, in that where I went to school, it was quite sort of dog eat dog. There was very much a pecking order. So, you know, sort of the status came in then. And of course, a bit later in life, when you start work, you know, the pecking order of the playground gets sort of legitimized in the workplace through hierarchies. It, you know, takes a slightly different form to sort of playground bullying, but, you know, it's sort of official bullying in a way, isn't it? A lot of hierarchies in the workplace. And, you know, between managers, supervisors, you know, those on the front line. And there's a kind of sort of competition between those sort of different levels in a workplace. And I suppose in that might be how sort of competition manifests itself for a lot of people, in that, I don't know, you're competing not to get your manager on your back for not doing a good enough job. And the managers are competing with those that are sort of below them in the hierarchy to, you know, sort of get as much out of them. So I suppose there's that sort of hierarchy angle to competition in capitalism, along with the other sort of aspects of competition, which you get, you know, directly competing with other workers or different organisations competing within each other. And dislike or hatred of hierarchies is sort of a big part of my sort of political sort of mindset. I probably came from the hierarchies you get at school, and then hierarchies at work. You know, you can never get away from them outside the party. My point, I'm starting to ramble now, but I suppose my point was the sort of just to draw attention to that link between competition as a drive and the way that manifests itself through hierarchies in capitalism. Yeah, cheers.
Yeah, I very much sort of agree with you on that. I mean, I have a thing about hierarchy. I'm not very, very good at doing that. But actually, we are dealing with it. But there's a lot of research to actually show that human beings have a drive to try to dominate each other. But we also have a drive to resist domination. So, you know, these things are actually both going on in our psyches. But apart from that, I'd always want to stress that I'm not disagreeing with you at all in any way, but I think it's always worthwhile always coming back to the fact that we are culturally evolved. We actually evolve through our culture. Our genetic inheritance, whatever the instincts we have, has to pass through our culture. And that actually is what finally dominates how we actually behave. So even if we do have these drives, our cultural values will actually overshadow them. And we know that, for example, like, I mean, I hate to come back to sort of hunter-gatherers again, but, you know, it's like, although there is a tendency within hunter-gatherers for people to seek status, it's very mild. The culture makes sure that it doesn't happen. So, in fact, you know, we don't have to worry too much about whether we have these drives or not in terms of whether they're going to interfere. Because, you know, as I'm sure you realize, within the hierarchy of capitalism, within your firm or within the school, there are very material consequences to your behavior. You know, you are competing over very material things. The world does present you with the competition, and the way in which you deal with that competition will have repercussions on yourself. And that's actually built into the sort of structure of capitalism. So there are very material reasons why we compete in capitalism. In a hunter-gatherer society, no such reasons exist. And although, of course, we can't simply reproduce a hunter-gatherer society, we can understand the principles by which they function. And there are ways in which we can introduce those principles into a future socialist society, modified to meet the conditions of that society. So, yeah.
We've got Aileen next. You need to unmute.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So this isn't actually Eileen. Eileen is with me.
I know, but I just read the name that's there.
Yeah. This is Andy.
I thought it was you, but I wasn't sure. So
it's
I didn't
all right. No, no, no. I'm wearing a different hat tonight, Andy. Richard, thanks ever so much. That was a really, as everybody has obviously acknowledged, a great talk. And I don't mean to make you blush, but, you know, we know you're one of the most thoughtful and eloquent speakers that we have available. So thanks very much indeed. I'm a bit nervous, actually, about what I want to say, because I didn't plan to say this at all in any way. But and I hope I don't get sort of picked on afterwards, but I'm just a little bit sort of concerned about some of the follow-up comments after Richard's talk, which sort of seemed to me to be if I may say so, a sort of anti-Marxist perspective. The case for socialism, the case for a post-capitalist society is ultimately because, you know, that capitalism is a necessary stage in human history, and you know, it's doing a very good job. It has done a very good job of developing the forces of production to an extent to which actually we have created a world. And when I say we, I mean that, you know, we the workers have created a world of abundance. A state of abundance across the earth. And so I'm just troubled, frankly, by the way that some of us are now starting to question that and maybe argue backwards against it to some sort of, I'm not quite sure what the right terminology is for it, really. You know, sort of back to nature the sustainability comes up, doesn't it? Obviously, and I would never argue against any of that. But I'm just a bit troubled by it, frankly, as, somebody that's always taken a very kind of materialist approach to the potential for human emancipation. That's all I'd like to say. Thanks.
Just.
Yeah, I think the whole idea of abundance, I don't want to address what you said directly, Andy. I'll leave that to the people who think that you're addressing. But I think the whole idea of abundance, it has to be remembered that abundance is always a relative term. It's like what is abundant? For example, hunter-gatherers, when they were first studied in the 60s, they were actually dubbed by anthropologists as the original abundant society, affluent society, because they lived in a state of abundance. What is an abundance for hunter-gatherers is not necessarily an abundance for other people. And one thing that has really been occupying me very recently is this idea about how the profit motive functions in capitalist society, and how the absence, what effect the absence of a profit motive will actually have on a socialist society. Because one way in which I've been kind of constructed in my mind is that you have production and you have consumption, yeah? And in between that, in capitalism, you have profit. And profit drives the whole process. It's the profit seeking drives the process. Remove that. So what is the drive? Well, you have producers and consumers who are now absolutely the same people. And people can then choose collectively to produce more and have more, or they can produce less and they have less. Yeah, so maybe a culture will want to put more effort in because they just want more material stuff, or they will want more socializing, which means that they want to spend less time producing and have less. And actually, that's what we find with the majority of hunter-gatherer societies, that actually they don't give a damn for material possessions. They really don't care much about them. I mean, I have one anthropologist friend who always takes a whole load of T-shirts with him because they like wearing T-shirts, and he'll give them all out. Within a couple of weeks, they've been dragged through the mud. They don't really care. It's not something that is of value to them. Now, I'm not saying that a future socialist society will abandon its concern in that to that degree or in that way for materialist possessions. But it seems very likely to me that people in a socialist society will choose to have a lot less than we have now, you know? And there are all sorts of other issues, because then we can, in a socialist society, we can actually choose to conserve resources in a way that we can't under capitalism. So an abundance will actually mean something much different to us than it means in capitalism. So I don't see a real problem about producing an abundance in socialism, because people can choose what an abundance actually means. The only thing that we need concern ourselves in socialism is if we have temporary scarcities. You know, there might be occasions when things go wrong and all our plans go awry and we have temporary scarcities. But we, you know, a socialist society, I'm pretty sure, will be robust enough to actually find their way through that and not be able to continue without a great deal of disruption. So, yeah, but yeah, that would be my twopence worth on that. You wanted to come back, Andy?
Yeah. Thanks, Dick. I mean, it's a reasonable argument. I just think I think differently. You talk about different cultures within socialism, whereas what I think about is, you know, ultimately we get to the universalizing tendency at the end of capitalism. And, you know, so I just have a very material, historical material. Well, I think anyway. I'm not there yet, you know, but I have a sort of, you know, that's the tendency, that's the track I tend to go down, is one more about historical materialism rather than this sort of just what seems to me, if I can be really frank, and I will get really picked on for this, I just think is basically a little bit woolly, really, because what we are doing is arguing the case for people to you know, not have as much, you know, in the post-capitalist society. I've heard this before, and I just don't think it's a very good selling point for, you know, for revolutionary libertarian communism.
Well, it's not an argument I would actually make to a capitalist libertarian, right-wing libertarian. So as an argument, I think it's a propaganda argument. I would choose who I made it to, yes, certainly. But yeah, I mean, the fact is, though, I mean, nobody's got a crystal ball, have we? So we speculate, basically, and there's room for different ways of speculating. So yeah, I'm perfectly open to that. You know, this is the way I've been thinking about it, and that's the way you've been thinking about it. And I can see our point to that as well. So, you know, we don't have to fall out over it.
We won't fall out, don't worry, Dick.
Right, I'm going to move on to Freddie, who's been waiting some time patiently.
Sorry.
Freddie.
Yeah, thanks for that, John. And yeah, I appreciate it. I've certainly found it worthwhile. Attendance is the first meeting I've attended on Zoom. I was a regular attender on Discord. And I enjoyed the address that Richard gave. And I also have to say, I enjoyed the remarks that, I know it's not Eileen, did you say your name was Andy? Is it Andy?
Yes, his name is Andy.
Yeah, I enjoyed, and I'm glad that Andy made the remarks that he did. At times, when I hear some of what is getting said, it's as if we're really trying to sort of rewrite the historical perspective of what the Socialist Party has been sort of trying to propagate over the years. Now, that's not to say that there isn't room for improvement at times. Of course there is. And that we re-examine what we've done and how we've done it, when we've done it, etc. That's fine. But we don't have a blueprint for socialism just now. That's a fact. And how socialism will eventually be, I don't like to be pessimistic, but I'm unlikely to see socialism, as I think most of us are probably in that boat. And when we refer to the animal kingdom, yes, we are animals, we're Homo sapiens, etc. I understand that. But, you know, within the animal kingdom, we were given sort of examples a little bit earlier on. If I've not misunderstood, we're given examples earlier on of the sort of the herd mentality or the pack mentality where, say, for example, a pack of wolves comes along and they have to act cooperatively with each other to bring down a bloody moose or something like that because one couldn't take it down on its own. So they act collectively and eventually bring down this larger beast. But then it very quickly becomes sort of top dog then, so to put it though, doesn't it? The sort of pack leader gets in there first. So it's not exactly a sort of socialist perspective that, or when you have your when you have your pack of lions, the lionesses apparently from all the sort of a lot of the programs I see, they bring down whatever it is they're bringing down, and then comes along, and then come along Big Daddy to sort of get his share first, etc. And I don't think comparing ourselves to that sort of the animal kingdom at the, in that sense doesn't really do us much good at all. The vast majority of us do behave cooperatively and actively with each other. And the party's been saying that for as long as I can remember. And there's much more evidence to say show that that is the case. So, you know, I always find these meetings, etc., worthwhile and informative. I do feel at times that we start looking backwards a little bit too much rather than how we can propagate more or easier or quicker the case for world socialism. So, yeah, taking on board what has been said, I would certainly say that overall, across the globe, across society, and even if you look at it just now, sort of maybe within the sort of rainforests, the way some of the tribes within the rainforests cooperate and behave and work with each other, etc. I think we've got a lot that still needs to be done, yeah. But I think that overall society cooperates magnificently with each other despite everything that capitalism throws at us. So whether or not it made any sense there, I don't know. But I just thought I would say something because I think what Andy was saying earlier on there, I have a lot of those same feelings that was being expressed there. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that. I mean, because I think, evolutionary biologists tend to refer to human species as a hyper-cooperative species, not just a cooperative species. In fact, in terms of the level of cooperation within human beings, there is no comparison with any other species on the planet. I mean, we're way, way beyond anything that any level of cooperation that any other species actually engages in. So I don't think there is a question there. And I'm also very suspicious about sort of using animal studies to come to conclusions about human beings, even studies on our closest relatives, chimps and bonobos, you know, because, I mean, depending on how you analyze it, you know, we have 95 or 99% genes in common. But, you know, it's like it really doesn't matter what the percentage is. It matters which genes which genes make the difference. And we're a totally different species from them. So I think, I think animal studies can be useful to the extent that they can suggest research on humans. That you know, if you see bonobos or chimps behaving in a certain way, or primates generally, then, you know, you might think, oh, that's interesting. Does that apply to human beings? And then you can actually do some research on human behavior. But I don't think we can extrapolate in any simple way from animals generally to human beings. But I don't actually think that's what, I mean, I'm imagining that the reference was to what Paddy was saying, but I don't think that was what Paddy was saying at all. Okay, there you go.
Right, I don't see any more hands up, so I think we may have exhausted ourselves in this conversation. I don't know if you have any summary you would like to make, Richard.
Not really. I really liked the conversation afterwards. I thought there was a really good conversation. So I think ultimately everything, you know, that needs to be said, well, that's never quite the case, is it? But I think a lot of what needs to be said has already been said. So I don't think there needs anything further from me.
Okay. Are we agreed that we've come to an end, or does anyone else have any point they would like to make?
Just one quick one, if I may. And that is the evidence suggests the more sociability is evident, right, within the human society, the more cooperation takes place. So the less sociability, more competition. More sociability, more cooperation. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I think we'll say good night at this point. Thanks very much, comrades, and thanks very much, Richard, for your talk.
Thanks.
Thanks, Richard. That was really great.
Great.
Look forward to seeing you at summer school.
Yeah, brilliant. Are you coming to summer school?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Oh, yeah.
I want to hear your story again and again. Okay,
you take care.
Can I just ask before everybody goes for John, you're doing the talk next week. Do you want to tell people here about it?
Yes, well, essentially it's just some things that we may do while we're living in capitalism, some things that would be beneficial to our survival as a species, and the same things which might be done to a greater extent once the revolution has taken place. So it's just a few ideas about things that might be ecologically more sound. That's all I could really say at the moment. I wrote something down about it, but I can't probably get immediate access to that. So I probably, even if I found that, it wouldn't add much to what I've said. So I hope that gives you some kind of clue as to what I intend to speak about.
Okay, thanks for that, and thanks everybody, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.